Hi, and welcome to The Point Being, the Arizona Daily Star's opinion page podcast. I'm opinion editor Sarah Garrett-Gasson, and I'm here with Edward Salaya, who is our opinion writer.
How's it going, folks?
And podcast producer. And David Fitzsimmons, our columnist and cartoonist and general man about town.
Yellow summertime, friends.
All right.
So we are going to talk about a lot of immigration stuff and how that connects to our daily lives here in Tucson, because as anyone who's been paying attention knows, immigration is a big issue right now, but it's also something that we in the Tucson, Southern Arizona have a vastly different perspective on what is really happening along the border and in communities, and how Tucson has responded. It's something that's not the caricature you see on TV, and it's something that really affects people day to day and how they help and how they interact with this issue. David, I can see the words forming on your face.
What is really maddening about what is happening now, as a longtime border resident, is that so much of this crisis is as a result of the president's incompetence, his bizarre, brilliant chess-like moves in terms of the border and immigration and the caravans coming. And we now are experiencing greater numbers than, what, a decade? A decade or more?
Biggest number since the 90s. Since
and
the
I can just imagine the fools in Washington are wondering, oh, I wonder why. I wonder why they're all rushing here right now. Well, it's because of Mr.
Invading.
Trump's...
Yeah. They're here to invade, right?
They're here to invade. No, they're here because they're rushing here before the gates completely close, because they listen to our maniacal president of the United States, and that is why they are here. And, of course, understaffed, undermanned, wholly unprepared for the influx and the flood, and not to mention this intentional policy of cruelty.
Which policy is that?
So many to choose from.
I laugh, yeah. Okay. Point taken. Point being.
Point being.
Yes. Savage.
It all comes back.
Touché. Yeah. Well, let's see, where can we list? Well, simply separating a child from a parent because we've decided to criminalize asylum seeking. Mm. That's the biggie right there.
Yeah, and I know, especially with what happened in Clint, Texas this last week with lawyers that went to a Border Patrol facility down in Clint, Texas, and found that 350 children were in a space for, I believe it was just over 100, squalor everywhere, children sleeping on the floors. And then what you hear from the Border Patrol is, well, hey, this isn't what we were meant to be. This is not in our mission. They blame Homeland Security and the HHS. And you'll hear the same things from those folks that, hey, we were never really meant to be taking in children like this. And this policy of splitting up children from adults who they know, either aunt or uncles, brothers or sisters, this is totally happening. These are family members who are with them. So these family separations really are taking. This is happening. This is something that is not what we thought we would kind of be getting into, I think, a year and a half ago, but there always seems to be this, oh, wow, we've lost 6,000 kids. And now, oh, look at now we're just stuffing them into what seems like broom closets. I'm worried about where this goes next. I think there's going to be a moment of where the public kind of out of sight, out of mind with this. I hope it doesn't come back into people's sight and mind even worse with. Who knows where this could go from here?
So. Oh, do you mean even more racism ginned?
Yeah,
up?
I think I'm worried that there's going to be a point where folks along the border, these militias, start saying, "Hey, why take them in? Why don't we do something with them right here?" I don't hope that doesn't happen. But I see this trajectory leading towards something like that, where people feel that they need to be vigilantes now, and
Yeah, it seems like a natural trajectory set by the attitude and philosophy of the President of the United States and the gremlin that sits on his shoulder, Mr. Miller, who is directing immigration policy as well. The tragedy of all this is that the mighty United States of America could easily adapt to an influx of refugees if we were willing politically to fund the enforcement agencies and to fully staff the courts, but we are not because the President of the United States has chosen cruelty as a policy in an attempt to deter the refugees from coming here, and so far it's failed.
Yeah, I think that this saying that I keep hearing that really sums up this is the cruelty is the point. The cruelty is the policy. This treatment of them is... That's the determent. It's not an actual policy of determent. It's being like this to folks at the border and hoping that these stories get back that, well, this is what's going on in the United States. Here, folks.
It's an utterly childish approach to problem solving because it doesn't address any of the problems. Mm-hmm. All it will do will aggravate the problems and expand those who suffer from the cruelty to greater numbers.
But the entire point is that I think that it gives, I mean, look at the theater, look at the image. If there's one thing Trump knows how to do, it's to make an image and get people to buy into whatever crackpot kind of thing he's talking about. But I don't know if this is some sort of on purpose or just the byproduct of how his brain operates. And that is, there are lots of people coming. There is a real crisis. It's a humanitarian crisis, but leave out the fact that we're talking about humans and children and just paint them as the hordes of people coming. You have that those optics. You have the image of people trying to come in. You have the image of, you know, people who are desperate, and you can characterize them any way you want. When you are in that position where you have created the crisis to use it optically as a campaign tool, it's entirely, it's Machiavellian, and it's something that I am sad to say that the American people falls for.
Yeah, and I just to that same point, I think, again, to that Machiavellian point, that they're doing this not only to get this word back to folks in South and Central America that, hey, don't come here. But I think with this policy, they're also trying to make communities like Tucson turn on migrants that are coming in that need help, to kind of when they drop folks off at bus stations or stuff like that. That's to make it seem like, hey, look, there's all these folks coming into your country. They don't even know where they're going. They're all throughout your community. What are you folks going to do? And at that same time, I think communities like Tucson have done the great work of saying, hey, we're going to welcome these folks. We're not going to criminalize them or turn them into some faceless mob horde that's here to vote Democrat for some reason and, you know, steal their jobs. I just don't get the narrative. So.
I think that's why it's a difficult issue. I think that's why the three of us here in this cabal of left-wing progressive Bolshevism here are sympathetic because of proximity, because we are near the border and we see the reality, and we know, and we've seen DACA kids and illegal immigrants and legal immigrants here in this corner of the world, and we aren't terrified by them. In fact, I view it, like I said before, as a problem that can be easily resolved if we had the political will to address it, politically and financially. But we do not, because, as you point out, Sarah, it's great optics, and it's so cynical. It's evil. It's despicable.
I mean, it's like he's putting out the casting call for the people coming who desperately need help, but you can spin that as some sort of coming to take our country or whatever. And then you then the casting call goes to those good Americans who are, you know, trying to hold the line and keep our country for us. And then you extend the casting call for the to the politicians who then curry favor and say all the things like, I mean, Donald Trump tweeted today about how Martha McSally is standing with him and she's one of us just today. And so it's casting call after casting call, and the it's political theater. And I don't think – I think there are people who honestly do not care that these are kids that we're talking about, that these are human beings we're talking about, because they don't see the humanity and is lost in those images. If you want it to be, you can, you get yourself off the hook by accepting the rhetoric and the line about who these people are, what they're coming for, and what they want from you. They don't want from you. They are here because they're desperate. And Edward, to your point about the hoping the word gets back to Central America, assume everyone knows how horrendous it is here. They're still choosing to come because whatever they face here is better than what they know they're going to face at home.
Yeah. Whatever hell that it is that's compelling them to come this way. If it's that bad that they're, you know, willing to bring their children with them, or in some cases send their children up to this area unaccompanied just so that they can, you know, escape whatever danger it is that's in their home country, that's got to be an ultra compelling force, especially when you know that they're seeing these images and they're hearing these stories of what's going on here on our border. So
I think the reality is, unless the Democrats miraculously take the Senate in 2020 and hopefully the White House, then the policy will change. And then my my second petty hope is that some kind of prosecutions might take place, particularly for the owners of some of these private sites that have, I would say, engaged in very criminal activity of cruel and unusual punishment as far as the detention centers go. Yeah.
So let's talk about the Benedictine Monastery and what Tucson has done to welcome people who have presented themselves and asked for asylum, migrants coming into the country. They are, for now, they've been, it's been since when, January-ish?
Yeah, about the beginning of January.
The owner of the Benedictine Monastery property offered it up as a place to house migrants coming through. Most of the folks are here, the guests are here for 2 or 3 days before they get on a bus or go elsewhere to meet their family and friends and sponsors elsewhere in the country. And so, David, I know you've been there.
Yes. And the first thing I learned is that these individuals are, in fact, not criminals, but simply asylum seekers who are here legally. And the second thing I learned was I really did, you know, being a white Tucson boy, I was certain there would be a vast cultural, societal difference between myself and those individuals at the monastery. And I discovered after being there 5 minutes that no, there was little difference, and it broke my heart. It really pulls up your empathy if you're a soft-hearted human being like I am, and wholly aware of the realities, you know, the issues of legal versus illegal immigration, but these individuals are here legally, and to vilify them is just wrong.
And Edward, you and I went on a tour not too long ago. What were your thoughts?
The biggest thing for me that I was struck by was the scale of the operation. I was thinking it was 30, 40, maybe 50 folks, guests, seeking some shelter there. And it can be upwards of, what was it, 250 on some?
Something, some, yeah. And then if they do get, there's overflow sites at different churches and centers around town.
And so that was a complete shock to me. I thought, you know, even 50 people I think is a lot. But when we were there, it was pretty packed. And just to speak again to the scale of that, the amount of volunteers and the amount of man hours that go into there in order to keep it running is just as impressive. So there is definitely the will and the spirit here in Tucson amongst the population, amongst the community, to help folks like this. So not everybody is buying this national conservative narrative of, hey, these folks are out here to get you and they're diseased.
But there are people who think that people shouldn't be doing this, that there shouldn't be a place, a shelter like this in Tucson. People who've expressed their, I'm just going to call them views, very adamantly, and that are reflective of, I think, some people who think, you know, I can't even say the words, but because I don't want that energy out into the universe any more than it already is.
Stay positive. There we go.
So, but what happens when, as we said, the owner of the Benedictine Monastery property, I mean, it's a private property. There are building approvals and he has plans for the site. It's going to be some apartment buildings and some other things. What happens now when in the next month or two when that center kind of closes and people will still be coming? What's the plan? Do we know?
So in my chats with Catholic Community Services and with kind of the unofficial mayor, Councilman Steve Kozacek over there.
You mean mayor?
The unofficial mayor of the Benedictine Monastery. Okay.
Yeah. We don't want to cause a fist fight between Jonathan Rothschild and.
We're going to clean that up in post, I think.
Steve Kozacek.
But from those two sources, kind of what I've been able to gather is, at least today, they don't believe any one site will be able to take over all the things they're doing there at the monastery. They are very encouraged that multiple churches and other sites throughout Tucson, kind of where they're already doing some overflow, they are encouraged that churches and sites will step up.
Perhaps some more churches will fail and actually begin to serve their fellow men. Men, women, people.
Folk.
Humans.
So I think there is some optimism that while there won't be a one-stop shop anymore, there will be multiple, not super large, but large enough areas where these folks will be able to, where these guests will be able to go and go through processing and get some food and shelter.
And once again, these sites will serve essentially as pit stops, in a sense, for these folks, right?
Yeah. So the other thing me and Sarah noticed, and the other thing that kind of struck us, was that most of these folks, their sponsors or their family members, none of them seem to be really on the West Coast. I noticed none in Arizona, some along the West Coast, but most were along the Eastern Seaboard or out in the Southeast. So I'm guessing that's where folks have families or members of their extended families who are willing to take them in. And even there, when they get there, they're still going to have to go through a ton of court services. And it's not like they are here for the duration of their lives. They still have to apply for asylum, and many of them are not granted it. So,
and I will say that the Trump likes to say that some incredibly small percentage of people coming from asylum seekers show up for their court dates, and so they're just
90% don't show,
which is absolutely not true. It's almost the reverse. Most people do show up because most people do want to do things the legal right way.
Yeah,
they want to stay.
Yeah,
legally.
Well, yeah, they at least want to. They just want to do what's right. They're not here trying to pull one over on the American taxpayer. Their last concern was the American taxpayer. That when you hear people say, like, oh, we can look into these kids' eyes and see future MS-13 members. Well, I mean, most of those kids, they were just enamored with my huge beard when I was over.
They were. So. You are, I mean, Edward, I don't know how tall you are, but you are quite the giant compared to those little kids who were looking up like a big, like one of the redwoods, yeah, looking at you. So, it was pretty great
so,
to see.
So the curiosity for these folks, I think, falls very rarely in the like, oh, what's the interaction here between your liberals and conservatives, and more along the lines of, hey, who are you? How are you? How are we alike, sort of thing. I think you spoke to it best. They're humans like we are. They eat three meals a day. They need water. Everybody's very similar to us.
So. And yeah. Why would anyone think otherwise?
There's a pretty good narrative.
That's a devilish question.
Yeah.
Oh, fear and ignorance.
Mm.
Yeah.
I've had more than one conversation with an individual who's so upset about the immigration crisis. Then I'll ask them this horrible trick question. How many illegal immigrants have you seen running across the road in front of your home? How many have you seen ever? I don't know, but I'm sure they're everywhere. They're just pouring across. It's like the Exodus scene from the Ten Commandments.
How do you live like that? Like, to me, that's got to be just such a, like, they're right around the corner.
Oh.
I can't see them, but
they're paranoid, terrified, and or the flip side of that is just plain mean. Last week, I took a call from an elderly woman I did not quarrel with, and here's the kicker. She had a Latina accent, and she's a long time Tucson, and they're lazy. They come here, they're just lazy. They want our jobs, and then they're lazy. I didn't even question that one. Okay, yeah. They want to work, but they're lazy. Yeah. You really feel threatened by an impoverished individual with a third-grade education who can't speak English as beautifully as you? I didn't even bother to argue, but for some people, these arguments are just so appealing because it's a great form of easy snobbery. Yeah. I'm far superior to these animals trying to claw their way across the border into my country.
Yeah. Unfortunate.
Well, let's turn now to some happy news, the Democratic debates.
Oh, happy, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh,
happy
man.
There's at least a lot of them.
There are. And I pulled them up. So tomorrow, it's tomorrow.
It is.
Right. Ooh. Wednesday, we're recording
And Thursday,
this.
Right?
Yes, yeah, Wednesday and Thursday.
Too
There's
big for
so
one
many.
Night.
Yeah. Wow. So
yeah.
many.
Yeah.
So they are on Wednesday. We have Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Tulsi Gabbard, Jay Inslee, Bill de Blasio, and Tim Ryan.
I feel like
I totally missed that Bill de Blasio was running.
So did Bill de Blasio.
Yeah.
And so does New York City, yeah. apparently.
He has a worse approval rating in New York City than Trump. So.
And then on Thursday, we have Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Mayor Pete, Kirsten Gillibrand, Michael Bennett, John Hickenlooper, Eric Swalwell, Marianne Williamson, and Andrew Yang.
Wow.
That's a lot of people.
What?
That's not a debate.
No,
it's not a debate, but it certainly reflects the diversity of the Democratic Party. I don't want to sit at home alone and watch this, so I've been texting my friends, hey, you want to come over and watch the debate with me? No. Oh, come on. Look, it's months. No, come on. No.
The one thing I will say about this debate, what I kind of like about it, and unlike when the Republicans were running in 2016, when they had kind of an adults and a kids table version of these, I feel like they've split, the Democrats have split their bigger names up well enough to where you don't have this like, oh, well, you know, we can skip Thursdays with Biden and with Kamala Harris. Those are some big names that are going to be able to come out and clash. Did they say Biden was with Booker as well?
No.
Second night, yeah, right?
They need to square off and settle this whole segregationist
thing. Well, what do you think about David, can you recap very quickly?
Recap the debates
what happened with Joe Biden and...
Well, Joe Biden did the Joe Biden, I'm friendly with everybody thing. I'm even friendly with long dead Republican segregationists. I will speak about them respectfully. And of course, Mr. Booker is an eloquent individual. Who understandably took after old Joe. And once again, it just points out what makes what makes me feel queasy about old Uncle Joe is he's old Uncle Joe, you know? It's generational. He just doesn't get it.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that part, but there's part of me, I was discussing this a little bit with my father this weekend too. At a certain point, there's got to be a realization that, like, yeah, you know, he is trying to do this whole I appeal to everybody thing. But when he's telling this story, it's like, hey, nobody asked him, number one. This was kind of volunteered out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But number two, and sort of to his defense, who else was he going to, like, work with in the like racial progressives were there in the
right
in the Republican Party and even in the Democratic Party at that time for him to kind of tell this story of like the early 70s about the, it wasn't you, like there was like hippies on the Republican side like
you,
oh, man,
you hit on one
I
of his
understand.
Chief flaws. That's one of his chief flaws, his inability to teach or to use a moment like that to explain a political action. Which I hate to go back to my close personal friend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, but he has that knack of trying to explain things. It was interesting for me to watch Mayor Pete deal with the issue of his racist yes. police force yes. in what's the Bend?
South Bend.
Thank you.
Go Notre Dame.
And I got to admit, as much as he struggled, I have to give him credit because I could have seen Uncle Joe Biden handling that same situation with folksy storytelling that didn't quite demonstrate that the brain, that his skull was permeable to new information beyond 1990.
Yeah.
What you just said earlier, I'm sorry, I got digressed here, but what you said earlier was a strong point that Joe should have made, but he does not do that. He could have taught that moment. He could have explained why one would have to deal with and such individuals, but instead, no.
The other thing I think this incident kind of points to for the Democrats that's different for the Republicans is, look how wide of a tent the Democrats have, how large of a coalition they kind of have to keep together. With the Republicans, it's pretty homogeneous as far as ideology, the makeup of the party. Everything is, there may be some people that flare from, from orthodoxy a little bit. Mm-hmm. But for the messaging for the middle of America Republican to a coastal Republican, there may be some differences, but it's largely the same. For Democrats, a Democrat in West Virginia is so much different than a Democrat from California.
Right, yes,
that is just a different animal altogether. And I think that for older Democrats like my dad, this whole thing was like, well, whatever. Like, is it really that big of a deal? And for Democrats more my age, the more millennials, Generation Z Democrats, this points to a huge blind spot for the old Democratic Party to where it was like, it's not great. You had to work with the segregationists. That let's not look at it as like, oh, it was great times gone by and stuff like that.
Yeah.
These are things that we're glad we don't have to work towards anymore. There are people that we're glad that, thank God, they've evolved, to some form of being able to eat with a fork and knife. So,
do you think that there's anything to be said for the idea that baked into kind of Joe Biden and the whole Uncle Joe idea, you expect this with him? So when he does say dumb stuff, it's like, it's just him being him, and that it doesn't have the same kind of weight it might with another candidate, that he gets kind of a break.
Dear. Yeah, that's the argument the Republicans use to support President Trump, and that's why I really cringe at the idea of Joe Biden as a candidate, because I hesitate to compare him to Trump. But I do not want another leader in the Oval Office who is undisciplined in his use of language.
And hands.
Her language.
Yeah.
Either. Yeah.
Joe Biden to me is like a typewriter running for president. He's very outdated. I mean, he can still do what he needs to do.
Right.
But I think that Generation Z and millennial folks, I think that, he does well enough with some of them, but I think that the majority of that part of the Democratic base looks at him as just like, hey.
But do they vote? That's the question. Do they vote? Because if they don't vote, then That's a different political calculation. And I think that voting, getting people out, getting people registered, getting people actually to participate more than just talk and more than just be on Facebook or Twitter talking about tearing down this candidate or that candidate from the Democratic side, which really just does Trump's work for him in advance. Do you vote? That is one of the big questions that I have.
I think the young ones are going to surprise us this election. I think they're going to show up in numbers. I think that Trump has kind of lit a fire under constituencies that may have felt not necessarily safe or kind of siloed to like, hey, we're good right now. But I think that women, African-Americans, people under the age of 30 have really, for the first time maybe in their lives, for some of these folks, seen like, wow, it's not always a straight arc of progress. Sometimes things throw a wrench into the system. And this, to me, is the big wake-up call. I see a big wave.
I really hope you're right. But women were part of the reason Trump got elected.
White women, yeah.
Not by numbers, but by the Electoral College. So, yeah, I don't know. How do you reach people? Because the young people, old. But
The youths
of today. Mm-hmm. You have to vote. I teach college, you know that. Mm-hmm. I will ask, you know, how many people are registered? And a couple people will raise their hands and I will give them the civics schoolhouse rock sort of, you know, I don't really care who you vote for. You got to register, you got to vote. And it's really discouraging.
It is a struggle.
I understand it because if I looked at the world today, I wouldn't think I would have a way as an 18-year-old to change it.
I'm thinking of my very narrow anecdotal polling group here, and those would be my kids, my daughter who's married and has kids, and my 22-year-old. When they both hit economic obstacles, for example, my daughter to buying her first house, she became politically engaged. The 23-year-old millennial working as a waiter, thinking, how am I going to elevate myself into the middle class? He's become politically engaged. So I think, as well as my revulsion with the president's policies, I think millennials are not only revolted by his behavior, but I think they feel an economic pinch in spite of the wonderful glowing economic numbers we hear, which I don't believe are trickling down to millennials in particular, or African Americans, or what's left of the middle class.
I think that when it comes down to actually being driven out to go and vote, I just think that Trump is such a personality, a character, that there's no in-between. There's no apathy that he inspires. I just think that there's you either love him or you hate him, you know, that both of those emotions and both of those ways of feeling, to your point, they do drive you to become more political, because you'll find, hey, my God, I'm running up against this policy or something.
Yeah,
like
not
that.
To mention the millions who've been sexually assaulted by him. If they vote.
That's another thing this week. I mean,
yeah, let's not waste our time with adding to the list. That this is a issue that is a waste of time. I'm just,
more of the same.
Sad, revolting, gross.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I just think that as far as the policies and things, I think those are almost secondary to the visceral reaction people have. Just
I couldn't agree more. I agree with you. The other day, of course, I was watching MSNBC, and the panel, they were so aggravated and excited about this story about the concentration camp in Texas. And I thought as I watched these talking heads, that's inside Washington. I imagine if I were to go outside my door of my home and knock on the doors of everyone on my block, hey, did you hear? No, no clue. No clue. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Zip, zero. Yeah. I think the informed political class is a very small sliver that we sort of talk to ourselves. Outside of that is a vast disinterested, I'm getting paid, I got my job, I'm happy, I'm doing fine.
Exactly.
I got to watch American Idol and that's it. Don't bother me with this other stuff.
More you of know, a voice guy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, history changes on the strangest things, like the Vietnam War started to grind south once the image of that young girl fleeing the napalm burned into our minds. We have no such image today, unfortunately, of the border, maybe save for the mom cradling her child fleeing from the tear gas. But we don't have a searing image from inside any of the concentration camps, which I think would be very effective. And that's where the Trumpers are brilliant, you know, closing down access.
Unfortunately, I don't know. I think that's just a matter of time.
I hope so.
I think it's...
Unfortunately.
I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunate, but I think that is... I think we're weeks, if not a month or two away from something along those lines.
I would hope so. And this also calls to mind about the debate in the sense that no matter how much we might try to prophesy what will occur, the debate could possibly turn on one individual on that stage simply insulting another individual.
So true.
And that other individual having a wry or witty response, having nothing really to do with policy. Yeah. But this individual will come out of the event a great hero, and the others fade away like autumn leaves.
Yeah, people might walk away knowing who John
Hickenlooper. Lick your water hooper? What a hoopy?
So, David, tell us about the wonderful fan mail you've received or calls.
Mail. I get fan mail. Let's see. All right. Fan mail. Well, this one actually is fan mail. I drew a cartoon of Sarah Sanders stepping down from a landfill. And Beth Allen writes from Houston, Texas.
Wow.
Oh, wait, Houston. Beth Allen writes from Houston, Texas, honey. Your Sarah Sanders cartoon encapsulated her tenure and the cost of the office and public trust perfectly. Thank you for your work. So much, Texas.
Could you translate that?
Yeah. What she said was, honey child, I love you. You can have some more biscuits. Stay a while, why don't you?
That was pretty good because there's a little bit of Louisiana in there, which is right because Houston's right there. So I like that.
There
that
is.
That was good.
Oh, I did get some hate mail,
oh,
which is always fun.
Sarah Sanders as well or no?
This was a cartoon about, wow, what was the cartoon about? It was about Sarah Sanders and her lies. Okay. Earth to Dave. And a responder, a reader said to me, what lies? Okay, so I made the mistake of wasting 5 minutes of my life compiling the list that, you know, I had ready to go. I had this huge list. Here are all the lies. Boom. What a fool. What a waste of time trying to share data with a Trump supporter. Yeah. So I send this list off, and here's the response. Whoa, you got way too much time on your hands. If you think you can prove all this, more power to you. Mueller's report, hearty har har. I'm going to have a beautiful day. I'm going to go to the range to do some shooting. I suggest you take up golf. You have a good day. Thank you so much.
Oh,
impervious. Yeah. A brick atop shoulders. That's what I was talking to.
It's impressive in a sense that, like, they can just, like, yeah, whatever. He responded. So what?
Yeah,
I got
what
something
a
to say.
Oh,
yeah.
What a waste of time. And I encounter this so often. I really have to struggle with a terrible attitude about Trump supporters.
Yeah, I can understand it. I feel like whenever I get any of those responses. I usually just am like, thank you for being a reader. I hope you continue consuming the Daily Star, both online and in print. So sometimes you get those folks.
Sometimes.
Just sometimes. Yeah. A lot more than sometimes. But so I think that is it for our podcast today. I think we've covered a lot. There is always more to cover, and we will come back to
next
Trump
Tuesday.
And the women that he the many women he has assaulted. Because that is worthy of its own look at. I think, and I heard someone talk about this latest allegation, or not allegation. I mean, this latest statement from a woman who said she was assaulted by him, raped, and that she didn't talk about it earlier because with everything that was going on with the, grab him by the beep, that she thought it was helping him, that sort of was helping him with voters. And so we could have a woman on, we probably will have a woman on the ticket for the Democrats. I mean, I hope so. There's some really good candidates. And that is something that's going to be a topic to come.
Most definitely.
I hope so, because it matters.
It really matters. It absolutely does. But until then, enjoy your week. I thank you for being with us. We want to hear from you. Email us at sgassen, sgassen, at tucson.com. That's my email.
Or you can email me at ecelaya at tucson.com. That's my email.
Or if you want to talk to me, you can email them.
We'll forward it.
And if we want to hear your letters and your guest opinions. Please go to tucson.com/opinion and send us letters to the editor and guest opinion pieces through the links at the top of the page. As always, our views represent us, not necessarily those of Lee Enterprises, which owns the Star. Thanks for being with us, and we will talk to you again next week.
See you later, folks.
Adios.